Broadcasting live from South Texas, this is your Petardcast. I am your host, Mr. Leonard Pierce. This week we'll be running around in the filth of our own self-referential jokes. We'll be joined in our ninth episode by raconteur, author, and all-around swell Hayden Childs, who will be discussing the ups and downs of a culture that has fallen out of the car and is waiting to be discovered by the highway patrol. We'll also be returning to received ideas for a new millennium, taking a pseudonymic tour through the improbable career of omnipresent cutie pie Julia Roberts, and much, much more. By much, much more, of course, I mean whatever sorry excuse for comedy I dig up before airtime. We'll also have another highly offensive segment of Jacques Hughes. Only Jesus Christ himself could resist tuning in to tonight's Petardcast, and that's only if healing lepers came with a side of fries. We'll be starting out tonight's Petardcast with another installment of Received Ideas for a New Millennium, an extension of the great work of Gustave Flaubert, who sought to collect all of the conventional wisdom of the world into one slender, overpriced book. People have asked me, do you agree with these definitions? Well, of course I do. They wouldn't be definitions from a dictionary if they weren't 100% correct at all times. Dissent. To be allowed, but not encouraged. In a dictatorship, dissent is not even allowed. Protecting dissent is not the same as allowing people to spout a lot of treasonous rubbish. Fat. Americans are too fat, except you. Never use the word fat, say something else. You are worried about fat people's health. Unless you're telling a joke, fat people should only be in movies if they're funny men. Gender. Should never ever be talked about, or should be talked about constantly. Gender is not the same as sex, unless it is. Germany did a very, very bad thing. The thing it did was so bad that Germans are never allowed to take a moral position again. Discuss the economic miracle. Germans have no sense of humor. Internet, mostly used for pornography and wasting time at work, but also made many people rich overnight. No one owns the internet. Call it the web, but not the net. It has changed the way we think. Use it in order to decry it. See television. Irony. It's dead. No one is really sure what it was, but we're all glad it's gone. Law. What separates us from barbarian nations? The rule of law. If someone points out that other nations also have laws, say ours are better, because of democracy. Say, this is a nation of laws, not of men. Marriage. Marriage is what we say it is, and we say it is something that happens between one man and one woman. Marriage is unchanging through the arc of history. Divorce, on the other hand, is fluid. Males. Stupid, bestial creatures who have ruined everything. Each woman is a creature unlike any other, but all men are the same. The male intellect, a contradiction. What have men ever accomplished? Natural resources. This phrase is difficult and should not be used. Don't get confused and say national resources. If you have no choice, stress that resources is the important word. Call them that because we're meant to use them. Nazis. Comparing things that other people do to things that the Nazis did is totally inappropriate, unless it's killing people. Postmodernism. No one is quite sure what this is, but all agree that it has ruined everything. It has something to do with moral relativism, multiculturalism, and pointy-headed intellectualism. No one knows what these things are either, but they're all bad. Race. Terribly important, however you define it. It's urgent to know what everyone's race is. Only discuss race amongst people of the same race as you are. Racism. It's not really a problem, since we don't have it in this country anymore. The president is a black man. To be condemned, but never pointed out, especially amongst friends. Talk about reverse racism. Blacks are more racist than whites. Television. It has changed the world. use it in order to decry it. See also Internet. General Washington revisits the topic of pensions for the veterans of the War for Independence. Some agitation has been noted among the ranks of those not paid. Mr. Madison requests that the motion be tabled until such time as the nation's fiduciary stability is assured. Mr. Franklin japes that stability would be faster in coming if Mr. Madison's wife could control her intake of fruit pies. General laughter at this remark. Motion is tabled. Mr. Hamilton asks if it is truly necessary to allow voting by non-landed male citizens. Mr. Adams and Mr. Hamilton argue at some length, with heated words being exchanged. Mr. Adams' argument revolves around the fact that the promises were made to the people, and the hope of this young nation lies in the blossoming of democracy. Mr. Hamilton's revolve around the fact that Mr. Adams is poor. Mr. Hayes suggests that it might be wise to provide contingencies for when women and Negroes are allowed the franchise. Mr. Gwinnett inquires, why don't we just also make plans for when we let apes and butter churns vote while we're at it? The Electoral College is discussed. General Washington fears that it may not provide the sense of a mandate for president. Mr. Stafford counters that given the difficulty of speedy communications with the farthest flung of colonies, the system is the best currently available. Mr. Hayes claims that this is going to cause immeasurable havoc once technological means for communications are devised, say, 200 years later. Mr. Adams asks if this might possibly be a bit speculative. Mr. Hayes replies that he simply wants his objection to the process noted. Mr. Franklin duly notes it, although Mr. Hayes makes a further objection to his tone of voice. Mr. John Adams brings up the topic of an amendment to the proposed Constitution guaranteeing the right to keep and bear arms. Mr. Hayes suggests that this is going to lead to disaster. General Washington asks if there's anything that isn't going to lead to disaster. Mr. Hayes says that General Washington can make all the jokes he wants, but this whole keep and bear arms thing is going to be big, big trouble. Mr. John Adams says that he does not see how it will make any kind of difference once the war is over. Mr. Samuel Adams concurs and also suggests that Mr. Hayes is an idiot. Mr. Hayes says that he gets paid for showing up either way, so if they want him to just sit there and not say anything, that's fine. General Washington inquires about the progress of the relocation of the capital from Philadelphia. Mr. Justice reports it is going as well as can be expected given the troublesome climate and insect problems. General Washington asks if there is anything else to report about the move. Mr. Adams says that happily the project is well under budget. General Washington says this is good news indeed, and is there anything else? Mr. Adams asks, like what specifically? General Washington says, oh, nothing, nothing really, just generally he wanted to know what was happening. Mr. Adams says, you mean like what's happening with the name of the new capital? Mr. Washington responds, no, not like that at all, he wasn't even trying to bring that up, but since Mr. Adams mentioned it, you have to admit that Washington is a much better name than Americatown. Mr. Adams says that he thinks Americatown is a great name. Mr. Franklin responds that Mr. Adams also thought Big Yankee was a great name. Mr. Adams suggests that Mr. Franklin suck his Big Yankee. Discussion of the proposed Bill of Rights. Mr. Jefferson suggests that the document is a failure in its current form, and if adopted as it stands, with no representation for women folk, Red Indians, or Negroes, it will betray the very principles of the nation. Mr. Adams concurs and says, at the very least, it would be nice if rights were guaranteed for those who do not own land. Mr. Hamilton says it would also be nice if we could fly through the air like birds, but that isn't going to happen either. Mr. Hayes attempts to interject at this point, but is shouted down by the group. He inquires why they even ask him to come to the meetings if they are not going to listen to what he has to say. No answer is forthcoming other than Mr. Hamilton's request that while we are on the subject, his face be put on the official currency. Mr. John Adams points out that we were not on that subject. Mr. Hamilton replies that Mr. John Adams can cram it with cranberries. Further discussion of the Bill of Rights with specific attention paid to the possible exemptions to the protection of the free speech and free press in times of war, or in exceptionally dangerous situations. Mr. Hayes asks, contemplate a sort of fibrous tube which could deliver, as if by magic, images of a pornographic nature to the homes of an average citizen. General Washington says, again with the magic tube that brings fornicating women to our homes, what is it with you and the magic tube? Mr. Hayes says that such a thing would be a serious test of free expression, and the members should think about it. Mr. Franklin said he would very much like to contemplate the existence of such a thing. Luncheon break. Welcome back to the Petardcast. We're going to deliver another installment of our never-popular naming of parts segment. For those of you who are just tuning in for the first time, Name of Parts is where we go through the filmography of a beloved movie star and look at the names of the characters they played in hopes of learning something about their character, which we never do. Today we're going to be looking at Julia Roberts, the eternally perky Georgia resident who turned a very toothy smile into an improbably long Hollywood career as a leading lady. Once again, the rules of naming of parts, we don't take into account people playing themselves, we don't take into account animation voices, and we don't take into account anything about the role itself. Only the name, because, you know, we don't want to actually put any work into this segment. Julia Roberts, who is very, very waspy, as you might suspect, has played a lot of waspy people. She's played a few people who have only first names, a Babs, a Jolene, a Tracy, an Anna, and a Francesca and a Catherine in the same movie. But she got pretty famous pretty quickly, pretty young. So she didn't spend much time playing people with only one name. She did play Tinkerbell, but I'm not sure whether that's a name or a title. She also has played a few people who have men's names, sort of. In Satisfaction, she played somebody named Daryl, but it's spelled D-A-R-Y-L-E, the way that the name Daryl is never spelled. So I'm not sure what to make of that. She also played a Darby Shaw. Darby is really more of a last name than a first name for men or women, but the only famous person I can think of named Darby is a man, so. And then she played a Von Seidel. Von here being spelled V-O-N, but no matter how you spell it, Von is generally a man's name. For somebody whose most famous role, arguably, was playing a stripper, she's only played one character whose name sounds like that of a stripper. In a TV movie called Baja, Oklahoma, she played a character named Candy Hutchins. But the rest of the time, it's been straight-up generic wasps for our beloved Julia Roberts. She's played an Isabel Kelly, a Tess Ocean twice, Hillary O'Neill, a Vivian Ward, a Claire Stenwick, that's a good one, a Polly Wheeler and a Patricia Watson, a Joanne Herring and a Julianne Potter, a Catherine Harrison and a Katrina Ludlow, the former getting bonus points for the super waspy nickname Kiki, a Maggie Carpenter and a Maggie Mercedes Talnot, a Lisa Wechter and a Laura Burney and a Liz Gilbert, a Samantha Barzell, a Susie Moss, and a Sabrina Peterson, the, generic murder victim name there, an Anne Eisenhower, an Anna Scott, and an Alice Sutton. That's a lot of wasps. She's even played three sort of generic super wasps, Grace King Bichon, Catherine Ann Watson, and my favorite, Shelby Eatonton Latchery, of course, from Steel Magnolias. You don't get much waspier than that. For somebody who excels so much at wide-toothed Caucasians, she obviously has not played a lot of ethnic characters, and most of the ones that she has played have been pretty white side of ethnic. A handful of Irish people, a Kitty Kiernan and a Mary Riley. Mary Riley. In Mystic Pizza, she played Daisy Arujo, which is, if you want to consider the Portuguese ethnic, that's your own decision. That's between you and your God. Once she played an alleged Italian in a movie called Blood Red. She played Maria Coligero. And then, of course, Erin Brockovich, which is, again, right up there with her hooker role as her most famous. But Brockovich is absolutely as ethnic as Julia Roberts is ever going to get. Possibly because we enjoy her so much as a, you know, down-to-earth pretty lady who doesn't actually do anything with her time. She has not often played characters with titles, and even then it's been waspy characters with titles. A Dr. Rachel Maness in Flatliners, and in Valentine's Day, a Captain Catherine Hazeltine, which combines super waspiness with a title that allows her to push people around. Keep up the good work, Julia Roberts. Keep being as white as you are, and God bless your teeth and arteries. Welcome back to the Podcast. We are joined for this episode by my good friend Hayden Childs. How are you, Hayden?
I'm doing fine, Leonard. How you doing, man?
Oh, shitty.
No, do tell.
Oh, we'll get to that later. We'll have a special bonus edition of the show for that. Well, why don't you identify yourself to our theoretical listeners? Tell us who you are and what you do.
My name is Hayden Childs. I suppose I'm on here because I do some writing here and there. And but for the most part, I'm a pretty boring guy. I promise you I will be your most boring guest to date.
Well, you've got a lot to live up to with that claim.
Man, some of us just have to work a little harder, I guess.
Well, some people have families, you know. Most of the people on this show are just slack off losers like myself, but
I know, but they're funny slack off losers.
Well, that's, you know, you get the wife and kids. We get the dope and poverty and sadness that we translate into hilarity.
Oh, I know. Grass is always greener, isn't it?
Yeah. Have you been doing anything lately to which people should be paying attention?
Well, it's nice of you to ask. Actually, I just had an article in the current Oxford American Music issue for 2010, and that's a barn burner of an issue. They've got some fantastic writers alongside myself, I suppose, your mediocre writer here, and they've got a great, fantastic, really, music compilation that comes along with it.
You also have a book in the 33 and a Third series. You want to talk about that?
It is a book on Richard and Linda Thompson's Shoot Out the Lights album, which is one of my favorite albums. It's a very great, dark, terrible divorce album. And you know, and so it doesn't appeal to people very much, I think. But
it's a good book, though.
And the way I went with it was not your crowd-pleasing 33 and a Third book, where I go out and I interview a lot of people. I ran into a lot of problems with that. So I wrote a part fiction book. And yeah, I think it's still the worst selling book in the series. I think that's pretty much where I'm at.
But, you know, that has a certain thematic appropriateness, since Richard Thompson put out one of the worst selling records of all time.
It's true. It's the his first solo album, I believe, still is the one of the worst-selling albums in the Warner Brothers catalog. Although it may not be anymore, you know, he's gotten a lot better known, I think, especially over the last decade. Which, you know, he's kind of gotten to this point where he's sort of the journeyman cult artist, I guess, and he's going to sell albums.
Well, you get to that's just survival, you know. You get to a certain age, and people are going to respect you for just not dying.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, his albums, for the last decade, they've been not so great. They've been okay, but you know, I buy them, and because I'm a fan, and then I suppose I help keep him going so that I can go and listen to him play the songs that I really want to hear him play.
I like that a thousand years of popular music thing.
Yeah, it was an interesting idea for him to come up with. To basically the story behind that is that I think it was Playboy magazine asked a bunch of musicians about their favorite albums of the last 1,000 years, or favorite songs of the last 1,000 years, and most people, you know, took that and said, oh, okay, you know, they really mean my favorite song since the 50s. And Richard Thompson said, well, I like some medieval chants, and so he sent them this list that they had no idea what to do with. And then he thought it would be fun to put together a show where he plays some very old songs and some newer songs, all the way up to Prince's Kiss and Oops, I Did It Again.
Yep. It's a crowd pleaser.
Crowd pleasers, indeed. Kind of funny coming out of a 60-year-old man's mouth, but yep. There you have it.
You live in North Carolina. You recently relocated there from Austin.
I did.
Slander or praise it at your preference.
I love a lot about North Carolina. How about that? Okay. North Carolina is a beautiful place. It's really great to be back here. I've had some friends. I lived here before when my wife and I were in grad school, and we had some friends here from before, and it's really great to see them again. It's a smaller area, I guess, than Austin, and it feels a little more. Here's where I'm getting in trouble, but it feels a lot more provincial here. I mean, there's world-class things here, but there's also a kind of defensiveness about the size, which strikes me as kind of funny. I don't know. I mean, it's a small town or a group of small towns here in the Triangle area that all, I guess, want to be more without actually having to give up that small-town feel. They're not really small towns, though. They're just small cities. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you call it North Cackalacka?
Only when I'm drunk.
All right. Well, you have a wife and two beautiful children.
I do.
That's pretty presumptuous, wouldn't you say?
That my children are beautiful?
That just having them. I mean, what do you think you're trying to do here?
I don't know. I mean, you know, I know the cool thing to do is to not propagate the species, but...
You think you're better than us, don't you?
That's pretty much it. I mean, I looked around and I thought, all my stoner slacker friends, I got to do something about this.
Yeah. So you just had these kids and now you're lording it over us.
Well, we picked them up on the side of the road, you know.
Yep. And all the rest of us just passed them by, you know, if only we'd known.
I know. Well, it's because we're good Samaritans, you know.
We got some peaches at the same fruit stand that was giving those kids away and we didn't even look at them, you know.
I know. I mean, you know, it's a hot day. You don't want to get kids.
I didn't have one of those seats that they're supposed to sit in, you know. Throw them in the trunk.
The back seat's sticky, too. I mean.
All right. Well, one thing that we ask people to do sometimes in the show is to defend historical atrocities or to cast them in a positive light.
Okay.
Do you have any Indian ancestry, American Indian ancestry?
I don't, but my wife does.
You know, I've almost never found anyone in the South who doesn't claim Native American ancestry.
I'm afraid I'm your guy. I'm pretty sure that we are just about as white as it comes.
Yeah. You go back to super white English Childses.
That's right. That's right.
Your people were too gentle to even rape any Native Americans.
I think they threw my people out of England because we were just too much, just wusses, basically, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I always thought, you know, like, I always suspected that whole, but I have Native American ancestry thing, was just an attempt to excuse being super racist, you know, like.
Oh, sure.
How can I be racist? My great-great-great-great-grandmother was 1/8 Cherokee, you know.
Oh.
But really.
Well, what's the story? The guy who was a speechwriter for George Wallace, Asa Carter, does that sound right?
Maybe.
He wrote a children's book, a beloved children's book under a different name that was actually appreciated by people for a long time before they realized that this beloved children's book about the Native Americans was actually written by the hate-spewing speechwriter for George Wallace. So,
yeah. Yeah, and I mean, really, when you say I have X, you know, amount of Native American ancestry, all you're saying is that your ancestors abducted some poor Indian woman and, you know, fucked her by force.
That's right.
Usually not anything to be proud of there. So what I'm going to do, Hayden, is I'm going to ask you to make some kind of positive statement or recompense or recasting, if you will, whichever path you choose to take, mm-hmm. for the Trail of Tears.
Ah, the Trail of Tears. That's a proud moment in American
history. Great moment in American history, I think we can all agree.
Indeed. Well, okay. The Trail of Tears. This was wrapped up with Andrew Jackson, right? This is...
I think we can all agree, our greatest president.
Our greatest president.
Yeah, our greatest president for killing Indians.
Well, he did well to kill Indians.
If that's your criterion for greatness, he's right at the top.
Indeed. And in fact, he was also really big in, like, bank busting, too, right? He was very much against the idea of centralized banks.
Yep. He also fought a lot of duels.
He did. He did.
Our duelingest president.
Indeed. So, but he was also, and this is key, he was also one of the leading lights of the Democratic Party of his age.
And that's correct.
Uh-huh. And I think it's through guys like him that we've learned about the importance of Democrats to caucus with. I mean, you know, when you get down to it, he was kind of like the Joe Lieberman of his age, right?
So you're saying that he provided us a historical example of the importance of, like, showing a strong party line.
That's exactly right. That's exactly. Well, and also, you know, having a big party that embraces all types. I mean...
Right. So, you know, they could say at the time, well, you know, we've got the sort of progressive, you know, pro-farm, you know, pro-common man wing of
That's
the Democratic
right.
Party. And then we've got the slaughter all the Indians wing.
That's exactly right. And they weren't going to be regressive like the anti-slavery Republicans, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those guys.
Right. Yeah, they didn't want to enslave the Indians.
That's right.
Just wanted to wipe them the hell out.
Exactly, exactly. It was kind of social programming. You know, it's really on par with the Montgomery GI Bill when you look at it.
Yeah, in terms of, like, progressive legislation, you would say that the Trail of Tears is up there with the GI Bill.
That's exactly right. It was making life better for your average guy who wasn't an American Indian.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's, you know, that's the positive side of the whole Native American genocide right there, is that one of the very few things in American history that made life better for white people.
Oh, I am going to hell for that.
did you hear Glenn Beck the other day saying that, like, the worst thing you could be today is a white American male?
Yeah, it's really tough on white American males.
No shit, man. I tell you, I can hardly...
Whew.
I mean, every time I leave the house, it's, you know, just nonstop persecution for my people.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I noticed that I saw an article today, and I didn't actually read it. I just looked at the headline, and so from this article, because I am ill informed, I believe that there is a move to phase out menthol cigarettes.
Yes, there is.
Okay. And so, I gleaned all this from the headline. So I was thinking, okay, menthol cigarettes are generally, and this is me being incredibly racist, I suppose, here, but I believe that they're mostly targeted to minorities.
To black people.
Yes, very specifically. And so the idea of phasing them out must have been more palatable to cigarette executives because... You know, they didn't want to phase out another type of cigarette that might be favored by white people.
You mean like all the rest of them?
Like all the rest of the cigarettes, that's right. And so they thought, well, I mean, you know, they're not going to phase out cloves either, I assume, too.
No, cloves are already gone.
Cloves are gone? No.
They are illegal now.
Goth dollars, man.
They are illegal with a capital L.
What are our nation's teenagers supposed to smoke?
I know. What are moody goths supposed to smoke in nightclubs now?
That is just a shame. So now it's moody goths and African Americans.
Yep, first, they came for the moody goths, and that's exactly nothing, right.
That's exactly right. And then after this, it's going to be Dunhills, I guess, are going to be
right, for Anglophobes, for Anglophiles, right. I suppose.
That's right. They're going to knock those out, and then pipe tobacco next for
college professors.
College professors and those who want to look like college professors.
Pretty soon, like if the current social trends continue, the only thing you'll be able to buy is Redman.
Red Man. Well, Red Man, I have to disagree with that. I think Red Man appeals to people who want to dip, but you know they want to they want to preserve the idea of tobacco for the rich man.
Really?
I'm going with a metaphor here, but I don't know if I'm going to get there. So you know, even though it's not within their own economic interest to ban Red Man, I think they're still going to go along with it because the guys who go around smoking Camels are going to, you know, be in favor of banning Red Man.
Maybe so. We'll see if your Don Draper-ish prediction will come true.
Yeah, I've even got a great idea for a advertisement based on that.
Well, I think we've already done enough racial hate damage in this segment, so.
Oh, yeah, I know. I guess I should point out at this point that I actually am from Alabama, and my ignorance is possibly understandable, if not excusable, for that reason.
Well, I mean, you're a white man, and thus, you know, you're a victim of near-constant oppression, so.
I am oppressed because I'm a white man.
If you're not thinking straight, it's not your fault.
That's true. But I'm also a product of Alabama schools, and, you know, so it's not just that I'm oppressed. I'm also oppressed and ignorant about it. I'm not really aware that I'm oppressed, even as you're saying it to me now.
Well, after we get done, you can look it up. You've got a whole new world ahead of you.
I'll start an angry conservative blog. How I am oppressed.
All right, are you ready to have a dialogue?
Yeah, we should do this dialogue.
All right, let's do it. It is the most infamous segment of time in American political history. It is the 18.5-minute gap left on the Watergate tapes, the result of an attempted erasure of the material by then-President Richard Nixon himself. For 30 years, historians, conspiracists, and Nixon's friends and foes alike have puzzled over the contents of the mysterious gap, but the answer was thought forever lost. Until now. Modern advances in magnetic restoration technology, as well as great leaps forward in sound editing with the advent of digital tape, have at last made it possible to reconstruct the conversation over the lost 18.5 minutes. For the first time, this magazine presents excerpts from the restored gap, a surprising series of moments between Nixon and his top aide, H.R. Bob Haldeman. Candid, revelatory, and sometimes shocking, it is a remarkable portrait in sound of our most controversial and notorious leader. So, what do you think about that Joey Heatherton?
Oh, I don't think about her, Bob. I'm a married man.
I saw her on Hollywood Squares, that show last year. Whew, quite a looker, I must say.
Oh, I'm sure she's great, Bob. Now, what about those goddamn plumbers squeezing us?
She was on Klimbim, too.
What the fuck is Klimbim?
It's some German show. I saw it when I was over there with the Cubans. It's like Laugh-In.
Couldn't we concentrate on the matter at hand?
Do you think I have a shot with her?
How the hell should I know?
You could pull some strings. You're still the president.
This is really more of a Kissinger thing, Bob. Do you like to do it like that, Bob?
Like what, Mr. President?
You know, from back there.
Do you?
What? Well, of course not, Bob. For God's sake!
Me neither, then. I mean, me too.
I bet Liddy does.
Why?
Oh, you know, he just seems like that type. I didn't even want to go to China. It was that fucking Kissinger's idea. Those people stink, Bob.
Uh-huh.
Nothing but noodles and ping pong and wall-to-wall commies. I think that's where dope comes from, too.
Uh-huh.
The only thing we got out of the whole goddamn deal was checkers.
What?
Checkers. That's all we got from the red bastards.
Checkers? Your dog?
No, for fuck's sake, Bob. Chinese checkers. Christ, why don't you listen to me?
Sorry, sir.
So, what do you call this again, Bob?
It's called 433, Mr. President. It's by John Cage.
Let's listen to it now. And so, that's how I authorized the break-in at the Watergate Hotel as part of my plan to interfere with the Democratic National Convention.
Sir?
I planned the whole thing. I had complete knowledge of it from start to finish.
Mr. President, I...
And of course, ever since that time, I have been actively covering up the entire thing, as you are, of course, aware from these conversations we've been having and are, in fact, still having at this very moment.
Dick, for God's sakes, don't you realize how incriminating this is?
Jesus, Bob, don't be such a panty waste. I'm gonna erase these tapes. Now quit being such a nervous Nelly and go tell Ford to put on the nurse's outfit and get in here.
And that was a special treat from the Petardcast. Hayden Childs has agreed kindly to write a new theme song for us, which will be featured at the top of every episode starting next week. And here it is.
Oh, a petard is a mine used in medieval times, in battles that are now mostly fables. Though it sounds much the same as a derogatory name to refer to the mentally disabled. And all that aside, here it's a metaphor for punchlines that are dry and not at all moist. So here's a podcast filled with mysterious laughs upon which one might be hoist. Oh, Leonard Pierce, you're Ambrose Pierce, so don't disappear into booze and self-regard. Make your obscure jokes, talk with obscure folks, and let us all hope to see you hoist with your own petard.
Well, that wraps up another Petardcast, and I appreciate your withstanding it. Thanks to Mr. Hayden Childs for being my guest this week. If you'd like to know more about him, visit his blog at fader.blogspot.com. Next week, we'll have a brand new show, a brand new guest, and the same old gags I wrote 6 years ago. If you'd like to be on the show, please email me at guests@ludiclive.com or use info@ludiclive.com if you just feel like insulting my upbringing. The Petardcast is always available on ludiclive.com, as well as in the form of a free download from the iTunes Music Store. This episode is dedicated to Mr. Charles Mingus Jr. and Ms. Jean Teasdale. And thanks especially to you, the listener, without whom I would feel even more embarrassed about doing this show. I am your host, Mr. Leonard Pierce, doing for internet comedy what John the Conqueror does for voodoo.